What is fear? How are our underlying fears actually controlling our lives? Do you think they're controlling your life? Maybe they are and you don't even realize it. How can we dissolve these fears, learn from these fears? This was a conversation we had with Bill Bennett, who's an Australian filmmaker and philosopher and writer, and Judith Richards, who's a trauma specialist. They came into our studio and we got really into this idea of fear. Where does fear start? And how can we get over our fears? Maybe even use our fears to propel us towards what we really want in life. Thanks so much for listening in to our podcast. Welcome to another episode of In the Chair with Bear. All right, we're here with Bill Bennett and Judith Richards. You guys are both in the movie Facing Fear. Well, you were not. Yeah, you're in the movie.
I'm in the movie.
Yeah. You made the movie.
I made the movie. Also put myself in it.
You also put yourself in it. And it's about you. You are the central figure of the movie, facing your fear.
Well.
Right?
Yeah, I guess I am. But I hope I'm not the central thing of the film. I don't mean to be.
Well, it made me feel like I wanted to face my own fear a little bit. And so since I've seen the film, I've been kind of meditating on that a bit. Mm-hmm. You know, what is my fear? Mm-hmm. Do you feel like you really had a breakthrough?
Yeah, I don't think it happened suddenly. I think it happens through the progression of doing the film.
Yeah.
In particular with the editing, because I spent a lot of time with the people in the editing room. It was about 9 months of editing of the film. But I came out the other side largely, I've got to say, largely free of fear.
Wow.
Largely free of fear. I still have fears of, you know, somebody coming out of a dark room and attacking me, or, you know, something like that, or somebody giving me a parking ticket. But other than that,
fears of parking tickets. Well, fear is, to me, it seems like it's a natural thing, right? In nature, I mean, animals are afraid of their predators, otherwise they would die, right?
We have to have fear. Don't go too close to the edge of that cliff. You know, it's and don't go near that person.
Yeah.
You have to have fear in order to survive. Fear. It's the biological imperative.
Right. Mm. There's survival fear. Would you say there's different types of fear then?
There is survival fear, but the fear that most people are burdened with is what I came to understand as being false fear or imagined fear.
Like existential fear.
Existential fear is my understanding of existential fear is pretty much survival fear, or fear of death, really.
Right.
Fear of death. And fear of death is a really interesting one to examine, because it is inevitable. It's just a matter of time and how much you suffer.
Well, I'm afraid of both death and taxes. and they are both inevitable, right?
Yeah,
so there you go. I mean,
unless you're Rupert Murdoch, then you don't pay taxes and you can pay the best surgeon to keep you alive as long as possible.
But yeah, you're right. Everybody has to face death eventually. So why be
afraid of it? And it comes down to, I think anyway, a fear of the unknown. You know, for a lot of people, death is an unknown. I mean, I guess for everyone, death is a fear of the unknown. And we're largely scared of the unknown. Hmm.
And that's probably what you were facing. With your fear of the Parkinson's?
It was about, several months after I decided to make the film, I was diagnosed with Parkinson's disease. I had symptoms which I sort of retrospectively recognized as being those of Parkinson's probably about 12 months prior. it threw me into fear, absolutely. And but you know, it was really interesting. Bear, the greatest fear I had was not for myself; it was for my wife.
Yeah.
You know, we've been married 40 years now, and I was. Those were where my fears lay. How would she cope with this?
Yeah.
You know, would. Yeah, you know. Yeah. Would our marriage survive? I mean, you know, those kind of fears, which is sort of crazy, really, because our marriage is very solid. But those fears came up.
Well, and also being that kind of like being a burden, right, to your family or something. I mean, I could, in all honesty, I think I'm not as afraid of my own death as I would be, obviously, like my family and my kids, or just being able to protect my family and being able to take care of my kids, you know. I would definitely rank that higher than my, you know, fear of my own death.
I found myself in a car accident when I was much younger. I was in ICU for quite some time. I was in and out of consciousness, and I remember my mother and father and my siblings coming to see me. I have recollections in amongst the fog of all of it, of them watching from a distance of me in ICU. And they were in great distress, and I wasn't. You know, I always remember that. I was fine. I knew I was going to make it out okay. But they were in great distress. I felt very sorry for them. Mm-hmm. And I think that's true. You know, that we fear the suffering of others probably more than we fear the suffering of ourselves.
Yeah. How it will affect others, especially our family.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think there's all kinds of fears too. I think there's other things, like I've been struggling just in meditating since the film with a fear that I can't even name. And I wonder if it has to do with something from really early childhood or, and I just read this book you might be familiar with. It's The Boy Who Was Raised by Dogs. Are you familiar with that book? By Dr. Bruce Perry. Anyway, it's an amazing book about childhood trauma, and I don't know why this book came across me and I read it, and then I started to realize, like, well, maybe, you know, things that happen to us early in our life stay with us as these sort of fears that almost drive us.
Well, Judith's a good one to talk about that, because that's her specialty.
So what happens is, you know, there's a child, you as a child, Bear, and you have a distressing event. Let's take away the word trauma, because people think war, they think refugees.
Yeah, it's not,
you know, it can be, you know, a sibling who bullies you or whatever, but they have a distressing event. So what happens? The amygdala fires, the emergency services in the brain. We release adrenaline, cortisol, other stress hormones, other stress chemicals, and the systems that we don't need shut down. It was all set up long time ago, you know, there's a tiger. Ah!
Right.
And so the systems that we don't need in order to fight the tiger or run or hide get all shut down. We don't need to digest breakfast when we're running from a tiger. We don't need to our immune system to fight a bacterial infection when we're running from a tiger. So all the systems we don't need shut down. And all that extra energy is sent to our big muscle groups so that we can fight or flee. One of the big users of energy is the frontal lobe. It takes 30% of our energy. It gets shut down. We don't need to sit and do mathematical calculations to figure out how to get away from the tiger. But part of that shutdown is also the hippocampus. The hippocampus is one of the brain structures that's largely responsible for long-term memory. And it can, in a dysregulated system, it gets shut down as well. What happens after we've got away from the tiger is, oh, the hippocampus takes that event, puts it in long-term memory, shuts the door, and well, that's over. Let's move on. What are we doing next? In a dysregulated system, that doesn't happen. It never gets put in long-term memory. It gets stored in the unconscious, like a videotape loop. The unconscious runs 90% of the time. Our conscious mind, which we think is in control, no, it's not. It runs 10% of the time. So in the unconscious, that event gets stored like a videotape loop. It's happening now. It's never brought to an end. It's never put in long-term memory, and it's over. It's happening now. It's happening now. It's happening now. The unconscious runs the body. It runs every chemical reaction, every electrical response in the body. And so the body is constantly behaving as if that's happening now. So you're talking about this low-level fear that seems to be going on all the time. It's what happened to when you were 3, and that event when you were 6, and when you were 5, and when you were 15, and when you were 22, and when you were 35, and it builds up and it becomes this low-level fear, which they're all there running in the unconscious. Your body's responding, so you've got that fear happening. And it's like the pressure in a balloon. It builds up, that event, and it gets to a point, and with some people, they blow out to more than that, just low-level fear, to anxiety, depression, and, of course, their spectrums from low to high, from moderate to absolutely off the charts. And so that's what happens. So that's that low-level fear that you're talking about.
Do you think that that's a really common thing right now, that most people kind of have that, or at some level have sort of anxiety?
It's epidemic,
yeah.
At the moment.
Yeah.
And it's a mirror of our society. It's societal.
Well, we set so many expectations for ourselves and for each other, and mostly ourselves, stuff we put on our, I have to be this level of success, this level, whatever, creation.
And it's also generational. Trauma gets passed down generationally. You were talking about your Polish background.
Yeah. Well, my wife's Polish.
Yeah, and family fleeing the Nazis. It gets passed down.
Yeah.
It's like a snowball.
Right. Yeah. And that, I think it comes across in just all the little pieces. So how does that connect to sort of like our intuition when we're tuning into our inner guidance? If there's that kind of low level fear that's always there, does that play into our subconscious guidance in a way? Is that messing with our guidance system, would you think, Bill?
Well, our guidance system is thwarted by fear. It's fear is the big blocker to intuition, because intuition tries to rise above fear, but fear is a very, very low dense energy. It pulls it down. We have intuitive responses all the time, but most time our fear, well, our logic, which is a function of that, our logic and rational brain stomps on it. And in fact, that's one of the reasons why I made the fear film, because I made this film on intuition, and I learned through the making of that film that fear was the root cause, really, of people not using their intuition, because they were too scared to run with coming back to the unknown. Intuition by definition is expansive. Fear is contracting. Fear always contracts. You shrivel up with fear. You go into you physically go into a ball with fear. Mm-hmm. Intuition opens you up. A lot of people are scared to be opened up.
Yeah. I don't know. I think I'm going to challenge that a little bit, because the more I'm thinking about it, I feel like fear is really just energy. Like, it's just an energy, and that we can use it actually to our advantage.
Absolutely.
So if there's, been examples in my life, and I'm sure you've had this experience where you're doing something big and you're kind of really scared to get, like, I got up on stage and opened for Rusted Root and 3,000 people in the auditorium or whatever, and I'm getting up onto the stage and I was like terrified, man. I mean, that's a good kind of fear. It's like that energy propelled me, and as soon as I got to pick up my guitar, as soon as I got onto that microphone, all that energy of fear came through that thing and allowed me to perform. So there's a way that we harness this energy, right?
It can be a motivator.
The same thing you're saying, like when the tiger's chasing you and you're running for your life, right? All those other things shut down, and all of a sudden you have this amazing amount of energy to do the thing that you need to do to save your life. The mother who saves her son from the car is suddenly able to pick up the car, right? And then we have all these experiences where people are doing like high performance sports. And I was talking to my friend about this the other day, because I've been talking about this since I saw the film. And I was saying, it's interesting how when you put people to that maximum amount of pressure, they will perform. if their survival is on the line or if their family survival, right? There are certain things that you have to, I have to do this. You will be able to do it. But if it's just you trying to do it to impress your coach, or you don't have nearly as much energy. So maybe there's a certain way that we harness the fear. I don't know. Maybe it's just energy.
It is energy, but energy can be both motivational, as Judith said, or can be toxic.
Right.
And the damaging aspect of fear is the toxic energy. You know, it's the energy that sucks that motivation out of you. In the film, as you probably saw, we've got a wonderful entrepreneur who talks about how she doesn't feel like she's really pushing the boundaries unless she's really scared.
Yeah.
It can be a motivator. We speak to a sniper, mm-hmm. one of the country's top snipers in the U.S. Rangers, who talks about feeling alive.
He said, "I never felt more alive than in that moment."
In combat, yeah. You know, so for those in those aspects, fear is very positive, absolutely.
I mean, I could see how it can also shut you down, obviously. I mean, that fear can be debilitating. Maybe it's not necessarily fear itself, though. As you said, nothing to fear but fear itself isn't necessarily true. Maybe it's not fear itself. Maybe it's our response to the fear, how we respond to it, how we react to it, how we manage it, so to speak.
I learned that walking the Camino. When I was walking the Camino, the one predominant fear that you have when anyone walks the Camino, which is this long pilgrimage stretch across Spain that goes like 500 miles right across the top of Spain, and the one predominant fear that you have on any given day is, can I get a bed tonight? Like something as simple as that. Am I going to get a bed tonight? Because there are so many people walking, and there are only so many number of beds where you're likely to stop. You know, and that kind of affects your whole day. And so what happens then is, a couple of things happen, is that you race like crazy and you see everybody else on the trail as a competitor. You know, that person's going to steal my bed. You know, I got to get ahead of that person because that person might take the last bed. And it spoils the whole experience. And I kind of had an epiphany where I just stopped and I went, this is madness, you know. Here I am in the middle of Spain, the most beautiful country, having this extraordinary experience. And it's being ruined by this fear that I'm not going to get a bed. Bloody hell, I can sleep anywhere. You know, I can sleep under a tree. I can sleep on the porch of a church somewhere or whatever. You know, as soon as I faced that thing which I called, what's the worst that can happen? As soon as I asked myself, what's the worst that can happen? And then I faced that fear, the fear went away.
Do you believe in God?
What's your definition of God?
Well, what's your definition of God? We all have different definitions.
Yeah. I believe in a state of higher consciousness that is all-encompassing and is all-loving.
I like that. I have more, I sort of come from an indigenous mindset, mm-hmm. which isn't really, there's not really a religion there necessarily, just sort of a way of being, a way of thinking about the world as a circle. You know, the earth is just our mother, very natural, always there to foster life, help growth, nurturing. That's the mother, you know? So there's, in my version of God is that, yeah, everything is sort of guided, right? Like it's sort of like something happens negative, something happens positive, you know? There's no real negative and positive. It's all just sort of trying to nurture us to learn, to grow. Mm-hmm. Challenges or opportunities to learn, maybe learn a lesson, maybe open up your mind, grow a little bit more. Yeah. Everything is pushing us to grow if we allow it. If we don't, then we feel resistance and then we get blocked. Right?
But Bear, so here's a question, mate. Why? Why is there a need to grow? That's the big question.
Well, either you grow or you die in nature. So it's not a need to grow, it's just that's how life expresses itself. it's a beautiful thing. It's sort of expression, right? So it's always expressing itself in flowers that bloom and trees that sprout up and all these things, this expressions of nature. So you're just an expression, right? And it all comes from this sort of oneness, which is all of us.
Okay, so I want to put this to you then. Do you believe that you are a part of God?
I am God.
Okay. So then, is your growth then a growth of God?
It's the growth is a constant expansion of the universe. So let's imagine that you're God and the whole universe is encompassed within every atom of your being. Mm-hmm. Well, this whole universe is expanding. Mm-hmm. So it's constantly growing. There's this thing of, you know, I study all different kinds of traditions, but there's this thing of the Buddha Maitreya. The Buddha Maitreya is the 30th Buddha in the generations of Buddha. And the Buddha said in one of his first teachings that in the future, there would be this Buddha Maitreya, the future Buddha. And it would be 30 generations after him that would achieve like this ultimate enlightenment. And it was this, people took it as a prediction. But what I think it really meant was that he was saying that His student's enlightenment will actually be greater than his, because the universe is expanding. So his enlightenment can only reach the edge of the universe, but by the time his student is there, the universe will be bigger, and so that enlightenment will be larger. And so by the time that student is there, it'll be larger. So we're always expanding. The whole thing is expanding.
But expansion is one thing; wisdom is another. So. Well, when you talk about learning lessons, that's about becoming wiser. So it's more than just a growth. It's actually and this is one of the things that I'm really fascinated about. What is our purpose, and why do we live the way we do, and go through, if you believe in the soul cycle, and the process of reincarnation? Why do we do that and hope that in every incarnation we get to an elevated state and an elevated state? To what purpose is that put? And the only conclusion that I can come to is that God wants to learn. And we are an aid. We are an aid in an infinitesimal way to the expansion of consciousness, if you like, both in terms of growth, but also in terms of wisdom.
Yeah. I think that there's accuracy to that. I mean, I had a teacher who was this crazy mountain man. I mean, I call him my teacher, but really he like lived on the mountain, and he was just, he had these prayer bowls, and he showed up in my life in this magical time when I was living in Mount Shasta. And he came in with...
It's going to happen in Manchester, but it's going to happen anyway, right?
Yeah. And he was... he told me this one thing one time. He's like, because I was a musician at the time, I'm playing music. He's like, okay, what you have to do is you have to give space for the angels. So he said, we're existing on this frequency. Well, there's all these other frequencies. And sort of at these higher frequencies that are out of our range, there's beings that are in those frequencies. We can't see them. But they can't interact physically like we can. So we're down and we can touch each other. We can feel intimacy. We can connect. We can feel love. We can feel sadness. We can feel all these emotions. He said these other beings, they can't feel that stuff. And so the way that they connect to us is through music and through these feelings when you get like kind of tingly, or when you feel like, oh, what is that? Or you have this moment. I remember playing music and having these like really like quiet spaces, and there's 100 people in like a dome or something, and the song ends and you can feel everybody's hair standing up on end, you know, like this moment of just like, oh, what is that? And he would say that's the angels. They're answering back. So you have to give space for the angels to answer. So he would instruct me to leave half of, he called it a conduit. He said leave half of the conduit open for the angels to answer. So you're listening. So eventually I got into the space of whenever I played music, I wasn't playing anymore. I was always just listening. It wasn't like me making the music. I was just receiving it. So that's, I think there's there's a kind of a combination of all these things where we, I love the way science kind of bridges into spirituality, you know, the way that when we think about energy, we think about form, matter, and then it gets ethereal, quantum energy. And we know, I mean, there's so many examples in the health of people spontaneously healing themselves, or all kinds of examples where our minds somehow defy physical limitations, right? So we know there's a possibility that we're tapping into. But what is our purpose? I mean, if you ask George Carlin, the earth made us to create plastic. That's what George Carlin would say. There's no real need for us to have a purpose except to experience that moment, I think. It's all happening in this moment.
And yet purpose is key to happiness. We can't.
Yeah.
It's a key to happiness, having purpose.
Yeah. I think everybody's purpose is a little different because we're all sort of helping each other out. Doesn't it feel great to help each other out, right?
Yeah, it does.
To contribute to the giving by making the film and having it help somebody with their fear. That's sort of a feeling of fulfillment, right? You get?
No.
No?
No.
Where do you get your feeling of fulfillment?
Well, look, I think if I make a film like this film for the reward of helping other people, then I think that that's a disingenuous reason for making the film. I think it's I don't need a reward. The reward that I get is by finding out shit, you know, by learning more about myself. And I hope that in the process of doing that, other people learn more about themselves as well.
Yeah, but it doesn't matter if you find shit out if you don't share it with others, right? Then what's the point of even doing it? Like, if you just did it in a vacuum and there was nobody else around and, oh, great, I found all that shit out. Now what's the point?
Well, I've spent now, 50 years acquiring the skills to make a film and make a film to a level of competency that other people can see it. And, coming back to my purpose, one's purpose, I think my purpose is to communicate.
Yeah.
I'm not a teacher as such. I don't see myself as a teacher, but I do see myself as a communicator. And so I'm very, very suspicious of people who make films or write books or whatever for altruistic reasons.
Right.
I'm not doing it for altruistic reasons. I'm doing it for purely selfish reasons, purely selfish. And those reasons are, I want to find out about how the world works and how I work and the underlying meaning for all things. I want to find that out myself.
Yeah.
I'm not finding it out for other people. But like I say...
But
I
you're a great storyteller. And the storyteller needs an audience, right?
The storyteller does need an audience and needs a way of... the storyteller can sit around a fire and tell stories to himself or herself, and, you know. And there's not much fun in that.
Right.
You're absolutely right. The storyteller does need a way of disseminating those stories.
Yeah. And that's what... I think that's the magic that you have in reading your book and watching your films, is taking that maybe complicated story and putting it in a way that it feels like a story. You know, it's a story now. It's something you can interact with, engage with, follow along. It draws your attention. It keeps your attention.
And you learn from it, hopefully, as well.
Yeah. So, I mean, that's an amazing skill. I love telling stories. I love telling stories, too. And I think that's interesting that there's no... You don't trust people with an altruistic intention.
Well, I can only speak for myself, and that is that if I do this stuff for other people, it's always going to be false. There's always going to be an element of artificiality. There's always going to be an element of trying to please other people. And in the process of doing that, you risk falsehoods. You risk tainting the integrity and the purity of what you're doing. I'm in the fortunate position where I'm able to finance these films in such a way that no one tells me what to do. I don't have any producers or distributors or sales agents or people like that, or government people, you know, who fund films, all this sort of stuff. I don't have any of that. I've got my wife, and she's scarier than all of them.
I mean, that's awesome that you're in that place of having that freedom creatively to do that.
Well, it's taken a while, you know, it's taken a long while for me to get to this point, but, you know, and I do regard it as an extraordinary privilege. I take that privilege very, very seriously.
Yeah.
And by that, what I mean is that I've got to be factual, I've got to be truthful, I've got to stand by it, you know, my work, and stand up to, you know, the praise and the criticism that comes inevitably. And
so is this new sort of passion, this idea of our deeper purpose, or maybe some explanation of what God is, or maybe is that sort of the next thing that you're working on?
Look, I've always been fascinated by the soul. Mm-hmm. What is the soul? What is the purpose of the soul? Does the soul exist?
Yeah.
What is the soul's journey, if the soul does in fact have a journey? Mm-hmm. And why does the soul go on that journey? Mm-hmm. And what is the end point for that soul's journey? These are the questions that really, really fascinate me. And when I look at fear folds into that, intuition folds into that. Mm-hmm. The next film is going to be on hope, you know, and that folds into that. And so that's the thing that I'm really fascinated with the exploration of the soul.
Of the soul.
Yeah. Because for me, the soul is the key to everything.
Yeah. Do you think children come into the world with sort of an imprint in their soul? Like a pre sort of loaded message or something?
Well, if you just look just purely scientifically, we've spoken about generational trauma. Mm-hmm. And it's been scientifically proven that trauma is passed on. And then that baby sits in the womb of its mother and picks up all the mother's stuff. It's subject to all the stress hormones in the mother. The stress, the fears of the mother, picks it all up. It's a little being. And then it's born, and for some people that's a life-threatening experience. And what is this place I'm born into? And then for the first 7 years we're imprinted. So I'm not so sure about the imprinting of the soul before. I could go on about that.
Mm-hmm.
But just speaking
scientifically,
in those first 7 years, the last trimester of pregnancy particularly, and the first 7 years, we are imprinted. The software is loaded.
Mm-hmm.
Our core unconscious beliefs are loaded in, and through that filter we will view the world, and from that programming we will manifest our life.
Mm-hmm.
Things like, I don't matter.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not good enough. It's not safe to love or be loved. Anyone who's supposed to love me will leave me,
mm-hmm.
will abandon me. I'm shit and I deserve to be treated like shit.
Mm-hmm.
It's not safe to have success. Don't stand out. It's not safe to be seen or heard. And then we create our life out of these things. And some people have fabulous software in. I matter. I'm enough. I can achieve anything I want. It's okay to make mistakes because that's what I learn from. But there's not many people who get that.
Mm-hmm.
And so then we create from that programming. So I know a lot about that, but not. It's a different conversation to talk about soul imprint.
Yeah. Well, I'm curious about that too. About, I mean, all of it. Like we're on this journey of life, you know. But I do think that there maybe is some truth to reincarnation, or there's definitely been examples, right, of people remembering past lives, documented examples of that. And that's at young ages.
Yeah,
you know, children, kids.
There's lots of children who come in
and they remember something.
They were this person.
Yeah.
And they lived in this street at this address, and they did this, and then the parents go and look it up.
And it's actually true.
Yes, they were there.
Christianity is about the only religion that doesn't believe in reincarnation.
Yeah.
And in large part, that's because the church wants to control you.
Yeah, it was a control mechanism because you die and then you have to either go to hell or heaven and that's it. You're done.
Yeah.
So this is your one chance on the stage.
And you've got to follow the rules and...
Otherwise you'll go to hell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that was definitely an effort to control people, right? Mm-hmm. We all know that, although many people still believe that, and it mm-hmm. Clearly worked because Christianity is the dominating.
Yeah, because not only will you suffer in this life, but you'll suffer for all eternity.
Yeah, for all eternity.
That's a long time.
Oh man, and it got even worse if you go to like Irish Catholic. There was walls, concrete walls, 20 miles long, and fire and eternal hell, damnation, all that stuff. So,
yeah.
I mean, I grew up. I went to Catholic school actually, and I remember, kind of when we first started learning about hell and stuff. But interestingly, then I went and I really started to research it at one point in my life. I was studying like, well, where did hell actually come from, and the whole idea of the devil, and it's actually not in the Bible that much. The whole idea of hell, and it's only mentioned a few times. Devil and temptation is only mentioned like a couple times. And it's kind of curious. You're like, well, where did this whole story of this, you know, guy, Lucifer, the fallen angel and all that stuff? And you start to, if you do your research, you realize it's actually like Milton had a huge part in it. The Paradise Lost and all that stuff. And just fabricating this whole story about hell and this angel of darkness and all these things. It's like, oh man, we really love our horror stories, you know?
Well, the church does, yeah.
The church does. But people do. I mean, people gravitate to stories that are...
Fear sells.
We know that. It's another way that, you know, fear is kind of dominating people, right? In the media and whatever.
People are controlled by fear.
Yeah.
In so many arenas.
So many arenas. Yeah. So getting a handle on our own fear seems like a pretty important thing for people to do in order to just navigate this world at this point.
Yeah, you, like Judith said before, you can't get rid of fear, and you wouldn't want to as well, because we do need fear.
Yeah,
you know, it is a very important part of our survival kit, but you can't be ruled by fear.
Right.
And like I say, I've largely let go of fear now. And you know, Bear, one of the really interesting things is, and Judith and I and my wife Jennifer were talking about this the other day. I kind of feel like it's sort of flattened out my emotions a bit,
mm-hmm.
you know, because when I was full of fear, I had real highs and lows, emotional highs and lows.
Yeah.
Now I don't so much. It's kind of a bit boring. I kind of wish I had my fear back.
A little more roller coaster going on. So you're up on the Camino, you're hiking, you're thinking, okay, where am I going to sleep tonight? And then that just becomes a sort of demon, right, in your mind.
Yeah.
Just dominating your day. So how?
Yeah.
Eventually, what did you do? Do you have to go back into, like, take me through the steps that where you just correct that or... Do you just think about something else, or do you like...
So what happened was this. I'm on a section of the Camino called the Meseta, which is about 150 miles of just flat, straight, featureless plain. And you've got this one track that's cobblestones, you know, so it's really hard on your feet. But what happens if you've got walking poles that make a sound, so you've got the clack, 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 you know, as you walk along this thing, and there's this one line of... like poplar trees on one side, and there's wind that's blowing. And so what happens is you kind of get yourself very quickly into this sort of metronomic hypnotic state, and you quickly move into a kind of a trance-like state. And that's why I love the Meseta so much, you know, because it's the part of the Camino that some people freak out on, you know, they can't handle it, they hail a taxi and you know, and bypass it altogether. I valued that section of the walk because it allowed me to go really deep inside myself. Mm. And what I started to realize, you know, when I saw other people rushing past me and I saw this kind of sense of desperation on their face, I thought, why are you doing this walk? You know, are you doing this walk to get a bed? You know, is that why a bed each night? Is that why you're doing this walk? Or are you doing it for other reasons? And I figured that for myself, I was doing it, I want to be doing it for other reasons, but I got caught up in this fear, as with everybody else. I got, you know, and I started to realize that that it was a nonsense, a total nonsense. Mm-hmm. And I let go of that. And then I started to think, well, maybe when I go back home, I can apply this to other aspects of my life. Mm-hmm. You know, I can apply this this sort of mantra of what's the worst that can happen, you know, to other, we talked before about existential fears, other existential fears that I had, you know, about loss of status, you know, health, all that sort of thing. I mean, I've now come to, you talked before about reincarnation. I mean, I've spoken now, just with these two films that I've done, I've spoken to enough celebrated and respected and well-known mystics and healers to know that death is nothing to fear. So I no longer fear death, and I don't fear death for my children or my wife or you know, those close to me. There's no doubt that I would grieve if they left. You know, if something happened, I'd probably be devastated. But it doesn't hold me in fear.
Yeah, fear is seems unnecessary for some future thing that hasn't happened. Like, well, why are you?
That's part of the problem, isn't it? Part of the problem.
I mean, why is it? Doesn't even logically, it doesn't make sense. Like, oh well, you know, why would I? It's like worrying about what you don't, you know, thinking about what you don't want, like praying for what you don't want. It's kind of fear, you know. There's this really cool thing from Tony Robbins where he says, you know, if you're a race car driver and you're trying to avoid the wall, everybody runs into the wall because they're trying to avoid the wall. And you're thinking about the wall and you're looking at the wall and you're trying, so you're thinking too much about the thing you're trying to avoid. And so the direction they give you is don't think about the wall. Think about the turn where you're going away from the wall. And then you start to miss the wall, you know.
Well, that can be applied to your health as well. So what happens is that I get the diagnosis that I've got Parkinson's disease. And, you know, so if I think about the wall, you know, the disease, then I'm gonna be the disease. I'm going to hit that wall.
Yeah.
And same thing. So what I've done is I have refused to acknowledge that I'm sick. And I'm not being in denial. I'm just going, all right, I've got some physical things that are bothersome at times, but I'm not going to be defined by that. I'm not gonna crash into that wall by thinking about it.
Yeah. I think that's a pretty interesting. Is there maybe an application to that kind of mentality and or the therapy?
Well, it's just really interesting. In so many ways it's so interesting. You know, the placebo effect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, take a sugar pill and it'll cure your ailment.
Power of suggestion.
Yeah, because the body in the unconscious believes what we richly imagine. If you imagine sucking on a wedge of really sour, really juicy lemon, it's got so much juice. My body.
You're making me like.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too. Oh, I wish you wouldn't do that. No, every time you do that in an interview, I saliva up. You know, it's really.
I know. I need some water.
Yeah, it's really, really.
Yeah, your mirror neurons go off mirroring me, because we all have the saliva response, and our bodies behave as if you're not even imagining it. You're just seeing me imagine it.
Well, yeah.
And the body thinks that's happening. The body and the unconscious believe what we richly imagine.
Yeah.
And so. And all these pharmaceuticals, we have them already. The biggest pharmacy in the universe between our ears. We have receptors for those molecules because we already create them.
Yeah.
And so in taking a pretend pill, our body goes, oh, okay. And You know, like I had hydrocephalus, which is the fluid buildup in the brain from the spinal cord, and there's nowhere for the pressure to go, so you have convulsions and seizures, and then you die. And they drill holes in your head to drain the fluid, etc. But I fixed it in a week. You can imagine a way disease states and the body and the unconscious believe what we richly imagine, for good or not. And so a lot of our fears come from the stories we make up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What if this happens? And what if that happens? And our body starts to respond as if it is happening, and we're projecting that into the future. And of course, we're creating that. You know, ask any nurse who works in a hospital, when are the most number of deaths?
Mm-hmm.
It's Christmas Eve, because a lot of people are given the prognosis, well, get your affairs in order, you'll be dead by Christmas. Oh, it's Christmas soon, I better die.
I mean, that's, yeah, the power of suggestion.
You know, and...
they say right around the holidays, more people commit suicides. Therefore, more people... it's like we, you know, the power of suggestion is pretty strong, right?
There's a lot.
Don't hit the wall.
Yeah, like, and the first thing with the fear, and there's another thing, you know, what's going to be the worst thing that can happen?
Yeah.
Which Bill says all the time. And the other one is this just a story I'm making up? Is this a real fear?
Is this real or is this
or
just
is
made
it
up?
A false fear? Yeah. Am I just making this up? Because we make up stories all the time. We're storytellers. Is it real?
Mm-hmm.
And...
but is there any difference, really? There's no difference. I mean, that's basically what we're saying is...
well, if we want to take control of the fear...
right. Because if we can also tell stories... in other words, if we recognize this ability, then we can tell stories that go the direction we want them to go, right? We can... we have a little bit more control in that. And potentially, if we start to believe, okay, yes, I can heal my body. It is possible. Look at all these other people who have done it. Then therefore I can do it, and so I'm going to do it. So here I go, I'm doing it. Like, there you go. What else do you need to believe? I am a healer of myself. There we are. So maybe there's a way that we can just, you know, there's a little bit of like fake it till you make it kind of thing, but it's also, I'm a very logical person, so I like to kind of look at the evidence. And there's plenty of evidence out there of people healing themselves from pretty dramatic, crazy situations, healing their spines from, like, you know, spinal injuries that they were told they would never walk again, and you're going to be paralyzed forever. Oh, how'd you heal yourself? I did it with my mind. I just convinced my brain that I could heal my own spine, and there you go. Took 3 years, but... so I think all of that is possible. Obviously, it's possible. People did it. If one person did it, then it's possible. So, why can't we?
We can.
We can.
We can.
We must be able to. Well, that's, I mean, that's good then. So let's do it. So what do you want to do with that then?
I'm working on it.
Yeah. Hmm. Well, I think it does take time, right? I mean, it takes time for us to unprogram ourselves. Some of that programming goes really deep.
Yeah, but it can also be a quantum leap as well. It can also happen spontaneously, and you know, and there is such a thing as spontaneous remission. Mm-hmm. You know, it can jump.
Mm-hmm.
It can leap. I'm determined to get better. You know, I'm told that this is an incurable, progressive, degenerative brain disease. I don't accept that.
And I've seen you getting better.
There you go. Now we see evidence. You're determined. We see evidence.
Yeah.
So the reason I asked you if you believe in God before, when we were talking about the Camino the first time, is I feel like that there's a certain place where faith really helps. You know, whether or not you want to call it God, or you just say, I have faith that all is aligned. You know, my intuition knows when all is aligned, right? So I have trust that things will work out how they're supposed to, kind of.
And complicit with trust is surrender.
Surrender. Mm. Yeah. Allowing it to be what it is.
Yeah.
And now it becomes a blessing. The doctor's diagnosis became a blessing because you made the film. And now now you're experiencing your own ability to heal it. So there you go. Is it a blessing?
I hope so, Bear. I mean, I would like to defy gravity. I would like to defy science. I would like to think that this is possible. I hold my breath, and take it day by day.
Yeah.
But I do believe that nothing happens by accident. I don't believe in a random universe, and I believe that this was given to me for me to use in some way, for me to learn and grow.
It's helped me.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, your story helped me. Your movie helped me. It's helping me right now.
That's good.
Yeah. I mean, I
mind you, I got to say, I didn't do it for that reason.
I know. I didn't do it for that reason. I know. You don't.
No. I don't give a fuck about you.
I know. You don't care one little bit.
But that's great.
Yeah. I mean, it's.
On Humanity Radio, you're allowed to say curse words?
Yeah, of course. Okay. Be yourself.
Okay.
Be yourself.
Well, you know. It's a very dangerous thing to say that to this young lady.
I haven't sworn today.
Oh, you almost swore in the movie, though. I saw the
She did. She has what is commonly known as a potty mouth.
Oh, yeah. I did want to play that clip, but we don't have to. Yeah. But it was cool because I love the way you were like, own it, own your, you get to choose.
We think that we are powerless. We're not.
Yeah.
We are more powerful than we ever imagined. And we think, this is the hand I've been given. This is who I am. This is how I think. This is how I feel. It's just how it is. No.
Yeah.
I get to choose.
I love that. And I sent you that thing from Pema Chodron. I don't know if you watched that, but she's the Tibetan. I ended up spending some time with Tibetan monks, and I got into Tibetan Buddhism a bit. My mom self-identifies Tibetan Buddhist now. She's like doing these courses and studying with the Rinpoche and stuff. So I've been kind of versed in Tibetan. You might find it really interesting because the Tibetan people basically spent lifetimes studying death and reincarnation and the process that happens when you die in order to kind of learn more about the soul. So even though it's a religion, they're very scientific in a lot of ways, and they did write everything down and remember to the next generations. And very interesting.
I've spent time in Dharamshala, and I've spent time with the scholars there in the Dalai Lama's temple.
Yeah.
And their archives and library. And they are extraordinary scholars.
Extraordinary. And in fact, some of the monks that we met, they were young. They were like 17, 18, and they had to cross over the border and flee, right, Tibet into India. And they memorized these Tanka's paintings, just memorized. Mm. And so, because they had to lose a lot of their sacred, the sacred texts or the sacred paintings. And so they memorized everything. And when they got to India, they recreated a lot of it. Anyway, I really love the story from her because she says, you look your fear in the eyes, get intimate with your fear, and then you ride your fear. It becomes your ally. You ride it like a bull, or you ride it like the wolf into. Mm-hmm. You face your demons, and they become your allies. Yeah. It's basically the message. Yeah. And so, here we are. Mm-hmm. Thank you for taking us into the facing the fear. I don't know how long we've been sitting here, but it feels like it's been a minute. Mm-hmm. And
Bear, thank you.
There feels like there's a lot more here to unpack, but I think that was good.
We could talk for a long time, I'm sure.
So
it's good work you're doing. Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you. Big thanks to Bill and Judith. Thanks, guys, so much for being here, making the trip to our studio. By the way, all the music on this and every podcast is performed by us over here, Mr. Bear and Mike Searson, who's also our podcast producer and director.
Next week, I'm really excited. We have David Goodknife in the studio. He's going to be talking about ceremony and ritual, incorporating ceremony and ritual in your daily life. He's a Native American ceremonialist and firekeeper. So that's going to be super awesome. And thanks so much for listening in. Please reach out if you have any comments, questions, suggestions. You can find us at our website, humanitymedia.net. And we'll see you next time.
In the